Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel. All right, welcome back to the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel. David, how are you doing today?
Nathan, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and we actually have a fantastic guest lined up for the listeners, and I don't want to spoil it, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right, well, we'll get right to it. Our guest today, Ken McCarthy, has been at the forefront of internet marketing and copywriting from the start. I could give you tons of examples. I'll start with one. Way back in 1994, I believe that's 25 years ago, a long time ago, he sponsored a conference, first major conference about making the internet a place where you could do business. Before then, it was sort of the domain of anti-commercial people, a lot of academic people, mathematicians, programmers, who didn't really like money changing hands, except when they got their paychecks. And so the internet then was a business-free zone up until Ken did this first conference in 1994. Now, one interesting thing that I think will give you a sense of how Ken has a pretty good vision of the future is his featured speaker was a pioneer at that time, a man named Marc Andreessen, who went on to co-found one of Silicon Valley's most important venture capital firms. And I'm looking right now as we record this at the April 30th, 2019 cover of Forbes magazine with a big picture of Marc Andreessen. Okay. This is Ken's vision. Now let's fast forward. Give me another example. 20 years from 1994 to 2014, 5 years ago from now, Tony Hale, CEO of Chartbeat, one of the world's biggest top major data analytic firms, wrote these words in Time magazine in 2014. In 1994, a former direct mail marketer called Ken McCarthy came up with the click-through as the measure of ad performance on the web. From that moment, the click became the defining action of advertising on the web. Now, you know, 2020 hindsight, you say, big deal, you know. Of course the click-through is the main thing. I look at click-throughs all the time, but you're saying that in 2019. This guy saw it, our guest today, saw it in 1994. So it's one thing to come up with an idea, that's pretty good. It's another thing to be recognized as the guy who came up with it by a leading authority in an article in Time magazine. Now, okay, great. So Ken's really smart and he's got a great vision, but as a copywriter or business owner, why is this important to you? Here's why. Ken's also a copywriter and a marketer, and he's made a lot of money that way. And recently he pointed out that there are some key things that these days no one's been teaching, and for reasons I don't know, maybe we'll find out, he's decided to share them with you on this podcast. Things that if you put them to use conscientiously could make you a whole lot of money. So Ken, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be on here. And if you want to know the reason why I'm on, I heard that David Garfinkel is the best introducer in showbiz. And I appreciate it, man.
I've worked on my skill stack, and that's right at the top. Thank you, sir. There's one other thing I want to tell our listeners about themselves before we dive in. And that is this: copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear on this podcast. Most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims and or if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. So Ken, again, thanks for doing this. You're a legend. I know a lot of people have spent a lot of money learning from you. I'm one of them. I think we might have mentioned that as we were preparing for this. I was at your systems seminar in San Francisco, probably 2005, I believe.
Wow. Yeah, 2003, I think, believe it or not. And Gary Halbert was at that one.
Oh, I remember that. He shook up the room. I think he said the internet's going to die, and unfortunately, it worked the other way. The internet's still here, but yeah, I remember. I went up and I talked to him. So it was one of the two times I met him. That was an incredible seminar. But tell us, you know, give us a little history before we start to dig into the how-to money-making stuff. You know, you were a direct mail guy before 1994. Did you have a business, a company like Haverhill's or Jay, what's his name? Or
Jay Peterman. I wish I had a business that big. But yeah, I did have a business that was 100% direct mail driven. So I know what it's like to go down to the mail house and see, trays of your letters, you know, stacked up and ready to go and worried to death that those letters are not going to work. And I started in San Francisco actually, I promoted seminars via direct mail because there was no other way. And the way we did it was write articles for trade magazines, use those articles as lead gen. People would write in for more information and we'd add them to the mailing list and then they'd be on our mailing list. And every time we did an event, a conference or a seminar, we'd write a letter and try to encourage them to come to the event. And we were working in real estate finance in those days. For people in the, you know, basically mortgage brokers and people that were actually buying and selling mortgages, which is a whole other concept, but people actually do buy and sell mortgages. And so we were kind of a leader in that field, and it was 100% direct mail driven. There was no internet. So when I saw the internet for the very first time, which was 1993, in a cabin in the woods in Humboldt County, strangely enough, a friend of mine said, "Hey, check this out." And he opened his computer and he's showing me the Library of Congress. I said, "Well, what's the big deal?" He goes, "I'm accessing the card catalog of the Library of Congress." And I was like, "Wow, that's pretty impressive." So that was my first experience with the internet. And when I realized you could send mail to people for free, because it was right at that time, 1993, is when all the big services started communicating with each other. In the old days, just for people that are interested in this history, Prodigy and little AOL, it was very tiny at the time, and CompuServe were all separate islands. You couldn't, if you were on Prodigy, you could only talk to people on Prodigy. If you were on CompuServe, you could only talk to people on CompuServe. And somebody had the really, truly brilliant idea, probably the most important thing that anybody ever did with the internet, which was make it possible for anybody on any online service to communicate with anybody on any other online service via internet email. And that was the big breakthrough, and that started in the late 80s, but the critical mass was reached in 93. So that was really the first year you could reliably reach anybody who had any kind of online access via the internet, via email. There was no web then. The web hadn't even been, well, the web existed, but it wasn't very pretty. The graphical interface for the web didn't happen until late 93.
Okay, that's interesting. So it sounds like your first thought from a business point of view was, hey, we can use this computer, internet, I guess, to send mail to people instead of having to go down to the mail house. And so that's, of course, called email. Duh. And today, I mean, email seems to be still the least restricted, most profitable way of marketing, wouldn't you say?
Amazingly enough, in fact, I'm working on a pro bono case right now for a nonprofit agency that lost their Facebook account by some bizarre circumstance, and they lost 31,000 members. I mean, just a disaster. And if I could convey one message today is, please, folks, do not rely on Facebook or any other institution for your online presence. Have your own website and have your own mailing lists. This group had never bothered to put a mailing list together. They only had Facebook friends. They got a lot done, but they were 100% Facebook dependent, and now they're screwed. So I'm helping them rebuild from the ashes. So I don't know why I went off on that tangent, but yeah, email is the thing. Online, yeah. Email is still the thing. Yes, not everybody reads their email. Yes, there are spam blockers. Yes, there's a million problems, but you're not going to have Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or any one of these guys wake up one day and decide they want you off the internet. They can't stop email. So that's okay. The bottom line on that.
That's great. So how long was it after you first saw the internet, the Library of Congress catalog, that you realized, hey, shit, I can make money with this?
It took me a little while because I was so dazzled. It took me a couple of months to sort of get my bearings. And the big breakthrough for me is, it's interesting, kind of an interesting story. My girlfriend, now wife, had a book that she wrote, a cookbook. It was nominated for the Julia Child Cookbook Award. I helped with the writing a little bit. And I wanted her to win. So I contacted everybody I knew in the world and said, vote for the book, because the public was allowed to vote. And one friend I couldn't reach, but somebody said, I've got his email address. And I said, what the heck is an email address? And so I organized my other friend up in Humboldt County to write my friend. I said, could you send an email to this guy? I didn't even have email at the time, right? So I said, could you send an email to this guy and tell him to call me? So my friend did call me, and my friend was a super internet geek, unbeknownst to me. He was one of the first users of the internet back in the 70s. He said, you should read this magazine called Boardwatch. So I got it. And Boardwatch was having a conference about, it was these role, the people that operated computer bulletin boards back in those days, which was pre-internet. And I thought about it. I go, gee, do I really want to go all the way to Colorado to hang out and talk with people in this weird, wild world? And I had a dream. This is a true story. I had a dream. I was in San, because I lived in San Francisco at the time. I was on Polk Street in this dream. It was so vivid. And there was a phone booth, but it was made out of mahogany wood. Okay, this really happened, guys. And I went into the phone booth, and it had a drawer with a brass, a handle. I pulled the brass handle open, and it was filled with rolls of $100 bills.
Wow.
Okay, that was my dream. So when I woke up, I said, telecommunications, lots of money, conference on bulletin board systems, I'll go. I swear, guys, that's exactly how it happened, right? So when I went there, it was 3 days of people who lived, this is 93, the summer of 93, who lived and breathed the online world. And that's when I really got it, because I said, this stuff is really complicated, it's really cumbersome, it's really hard to use, and yet there are hundreds of thousands of people going through, crawling over broken glass naked just to be able to communicate with each other online. When this becomes easy for people, this is going to explode. And I had a notebook with me, one of those, wide-ruled school notebooks with the marble, black marble, which is still my favorite business tool. And I wrote and wrote and wrote every thing that occurred to me. And when I got home, luckily enough, I came home to San Francisco, which it's a good thing I didn't live in Tulsa or Baton Rouge or Minneapolis, because I would have been out of luck. But I lived right at ground zero of the internet revolution. So I just went out and networked with everybody that I could. And what I discovered, which was bizarre, was that there was this large population of digital media people. This is pre-CD-ROM. There were no CD-ROMs. And they were developing interactive video kiosks and all kinds of wild, expensive stuff. And then on the other side, you had the internet guys who were, really, they were excited about communicating with people all over the world and having archives and all this stuff. And they didn't talk to each other at all.
Oh, you've done a lot of conferences, right? A lot of bringing people together. That's the rule, not the exception, right? You always have people that, in your mind, obviously should be talking to each other for their own benefit and the benefit of others, but in their minds it's like, why? Or I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah, I'm still, I should get over it, but I'm still shocked. These things seem so obvious to me, you know? It's like, why do guys don't you get it? And, you know, so the internet people would be like, well, we don't do that. And the multimedia people, they were called multimedia in those days, they were like, well, we can't put our CD, our interactive video over the internet. It there's not enough bandwidth. And I said, yeah, but someday there will be, you know, don't you guys see this is, you know, and I'm not, and the irony is I am not a technical guy. I am a copywriter. Okay. Just so everybody understands that first and foremost, I don't think of myself as an internet guy. I think of myself as a copywriter who got involved in the internet thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I had to hire a tutor to show me how to send and receive email. It took several sessions. I'm not exaggerating. It was pathetic, you know. But the business case was just so strong, and it all came down to my, you know, doing my campaigns, my direct mail campaigns, going down to the letter shop, handing the guy the check, sweating bullets that, oh my God, this could be the end. You know, this could be a mailing that goes out. Cause you know, I'd make money. I'd pay the rent. I'd, you know, have some extra cash, but then I had to, you know, turn the wheel again. And, well, and yeah.
You're sparking so many ideas in my mind. So a few weeks ago, we had a guy named Tom Antion on, and we coming up, you know, Tom?
Of course. He was a colleague way back when. He's a speaker at some of the early events. Yeah.
Yeah, and same here. And I was remembering a conference, a seminar he and I gave in Marin County. And I'm sure you know where that is. For yep. people who don't, it's the county right north of San Francisco. And we kept coming up with these Marin County references. And he made some crazy joke about hunting in Marin County. And anyway, I was just thinking of an ad, you know, sort of like a tourism ad of some guy holding a really thick, you know, smoking joint and, you know, a picture of you discovering the internet and says Humboldt County where great things happen, something like that. The other thing I wanted to say is it's really interesting what you were saying about going down the mail house, the trays, handing the guy the check. Because when Gary Halbert used to mentor people, he would, I think, charge them $27,000. And the first thing he would do would be to make them lick stamps and stuff envelopes and take trays down to the mail house. And it's funny. I mean, some of those people, like Caleb O'Dowd, are incredibly smart marketers and great copywriters, but nobody could really understand that who hasn't been through one of those drills. But there is something about the whole tactile aspect of doing that and the experience and wondering the post office is going to steal your mail or the guy's going to overcharge you on postage or short you on pieces, all of those things, right?
Yep.
Somehow that sharpens the mind.
Well, my understanding is that Dan Kennedy, even to this day, when he's mailing to his inner circle people, they do that mailer out of his home. And there is, it definitely sharpens the mind. It may even, I'm thinking of music here. You know, if you've only ever done electronic music and you've only pushed buttons and you've only, you know, turned dials, you're missing the dimension of an actual drum, yeah. You know, or an actual trumpet. And there is a tremendous amount of richness and vitality in those physical instruments. And they suggest a lot and they're inspirational. And the other thing too is with when you see the physicality of it, you realize the deadly seriousness of it. Mm-hmm. And whereas email, you know, you can if you only know email and have only ever known email, it can be very easy to get lazy and sloppy and careless. And that's the big problem I see with email only folks who don't have any kind of a physical background in
direct. Well, let's use that to transition into some of the things you learned as a direct mail financial and then later internet marketing seminar promoter, and maybe relate it to email today. I'm sure you look at emails and you just shake your head or you know, try to keep your lunch down or whatever after you've read them. I got the impression that we didn't get to this explicitly. I got the impression from our back and forth that you see almost a whole lost generation of copywriters out there who haven't understood some of the basic things that you had to learn in at the time, which was the hardest way possible. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Okay. So where to begin? Let me start with something that Ted Nicholas said, who's a great copywriter in his own right.
Oh, yeah, I remember Ted. I liked him, met him. Yep.
And hired a lot of great copywriters. And for people that don't know him, he had a lot of different ventures, but the one that really clicked was he had something called, I think it was called the Corporation Company. Mm-hmm. And he would run these little tiny ads, and they'd sometimes full-page ads, but often small ads too. And he basically built a very successful business registering, teaching people the virtues of having their own corporation, and then also providing the back-end corporate services, which are ongoing. And then he was able to sell that company for a lot of money. And he's taught people how to write copy. I think he had a book called The Golden Mailbox. Did he?
Yeah, he did. And he had, I subscribed to his newsletter for a while. I think it was called the Ted Nicholas Newsletter, another book called Magic Words That Bring You Riches.
Yep. And he said this about career advice for copywriters, and I wholeheartedly agree. One of the best ways to become an in-demand copywriter is to start your own business. Use copy and make money at it. Number one, you're going to learn a lot in the process. You know, it's live or die. And number two, you've then generated your proof that you're a good copywriter. And I went that route, not consciously or deliberately or with a plan or based on his advice, because I just did it because in when I started, it wasn't obvious to me how I could plug in and be a copywriter for anybody else. There wasn't this culture now. I mean, now people know what a copywriter is. A lot of people know that it's a good idea to hire a copywriter. I mean, David, you remember that this was a really rarefied and specialized world.
I do.
Yeah. Now it's people get it, which is a good thing on the one side. On the other side, though, people, I think, are underestimate how much craft is involved in doing it well. And so for the beginner or the fledgling or the apprentice or the journeyman, nothing will teach you faster than finding a product or a service or an event or a cause that you believe in, and rolling up your sleeves and writing for that. And seeing what happens, you know, it's a very different experience than writing for a client.
You know, we've never talked about this on the podcast before. And of course, you and I have never talked about this particular topic, Ken, but I really appreciate what you're saying. And I'll tell you why. I talk about it myself. I've had clients who I have two types of mentoring clients. One are pure copywriters. Maybe not pure as the driven snow, but copywriting is what they do. And then I have business owners who want to write copy. And sometimes I do have people like you're talking about, you were thinking of becoming, although you never did, you know, a professional copywriter who had run their own business. And one of the things I say is it makes all the difference in the world when there are stakes and the stakes are high. When you have skin in the game, when it really freaking matters whether it works or not, whether when you feel a little bit of that fear creeping up that, oh, shit, what if this doesn't work? Man, you know, and it matters. And maybe you're even thinking about mouths not getting fed, people going bankrupt. I mean, you don't have to get that paranoid to realize that you can put a lot on the line with a campaign. And if it doesn't work, it's like a bad bet at the poker table. where the bet was in the four or five or six figures. So I love that you brought that up. And I think, it also relates to what you're talking about music, because I've gotten into music recently and I started out with very physical instruments, guitar and tuba. And I'm doing a lot of electronic stuff, and you can make stuff that sounds really good, kind of, totally with a computer and with a keyboard. I mean, a computer keyboard and with a mouse. But wow, when there's a physical aspect of creating it, there's just a different dimension. I don't even know if you can quantify it, but you can feel it.
I couldn't agree more. And all this virtual stuff is all great, but it's relatively new. we're kind of hardwired for the physical world. They call it the virtual world for a reason. It's yep. not the real world, this skin in the game is a great phrase. To quote Gary Halbert again, he often used the analogy of what would you do if there was a gun to your head and this letter had to work?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how because I felt the gun to my head. I didn't have money. If my things didn't work, I might not have been able to pay my rent or eat very well that month.
But eventually you started making a ton of money with this, right?
Yep. I right place, right time, right topic, right stuff, and for the early years in the early 90s and 94, especially 94, I was kind of it in the Bay Area. It was just hard to imagine. Sometimes I talk about this, I'm like, did that really happen? But you know what? It actually really did happen. Late 94, early 95, I was kind of the foremost person in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, on the issue of commercialization of the internet. I mean, I was invited to speak everywhere. I was doing events all the time. I was, so I made some money that way. I started a hosting business, and it was a great business. I was using other people's servers. I didn't really run the servers or anything. I just subcontracted all that out. And it was just, nobody knew how to put up a website. Nobody knew how to handle the hosting. So we just had hundreds and hundreds of clients and we charged them a lot of money each. And it was a phenomenal business. Then I got very connected with Dan Kennedy, who I referred to earlier, who's very solid direct marketing guy, especially in the entrepreneurial world. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty much the only guy that he would allow speak to his, I was the only guy that he would allow speak to his audiences on the subject of online marketing from 93 till he sold the company to Bill Glazer in 2003. I was it. So every time he did a con, his audiences were fantastic because the audience was 100% hardcore direct marketing oriented entrepreneur business owners, not just business owners, right? Not people dreaming of being entrepreneurs, but like guys that actually own businesses that totally understood direct marketing. And so it was very much shooting fish in a barrel for me, so that when it was time for me to do conferences, very, very specific conferences on how to use the internet as it was developing as an online medium, I had this massive database of people that I accumulated by speaking at his events. So you saw the size of the event in...
God. Yeah, I could barely move. The crowd was so thick.
Yeah, and that was what we were doing. And we did about 55 of them at that level. Wow. And believe it or not, I don't know how we did this. And it's not a testament to my skill. It's a testament to my inability to manage people. That whole company was just me and an assistant.
Writer types don't really like the management structures they talk about in Harvard Business Review, right?
I don't know how people do it. I don't know how you find employees. I don't know how you manage them. I don't know how you keep them from driving you crazy. How you pay them every month. I just don't get it. I don't know how it works.
I remember right around the time you were like Mr. Commercialization of the internet, I was sort of coming out of bankruptcy, Well, I didn't actually technically go bankrupt, but close enough. And I was teaching public speaking with another guy, and he had, and I, we both sort of had the same idea about employees and employers and management structures. He said that he thought you should just get a bunch of dogs to carry briefcases down to the financial district in San Francisco, and it would save everyone a lot of money. Listen, I would, we got to wrap up, but would you be willing to come back next week and dig down a little deeper into some of your copywriting stuff, because this is fascinating, but we're just out of time today.
I'd be pleased. It'd be wonderful to come back and talk more. I love this topic, and I'm enjoying talking with you.
Thanks. Me too. So Nathan, you want to wrap us up and we can pick this up in 7 days?
Absolutely. So we got Ken coming back on the next episode. In between now and then, though, is there somewhere where people can go to find out more about you, Ken?
Oh, thanks for asking. I finally, I'm the shoemaker without shoes, you know, but I finally whipped my personal website into shape. So people could go to kenmccarthy.com.
Awesome. Okay. All right. So check out kenmccarthy.com. And if you want more of your podcast fix, head on over to copywriterspodcast.com, and we will catch you next time.
Catch you next time. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes so you never miss an episode.
This show was brought to you by the Copy and Funnels Podcast Network.
All right, welcome back to the Copywriters Podcast. And we've got a continuation. We had a fantastic episode last time, and luckily our guest decided to come back on and spill some more of his knowledge on. So, you know, before we jump into it, I messed up. I got to introduce the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel. David, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Nathan, and that's okay. This show really is about Ken. If you guys remember from last week, he really is maybe the internet copywriting pioneer, the real one. And he learned his craft in direct mail, as a lot of the founders in this business always have, from back to 1905 and Claude Hopkins. Ken's not that old. Not old at all. But anyway, Ken's back with us, and we spent a lot of time last week talking about history. This time, I think, Ken, you said you'd like to share a lot of fundamentals and some ideas and some insights about copywriting itself, yes?
Absolutely, yep.
Great. Well, thanks for returning, first of all. And secondly, just a friendly reminder to everyone who hasn't heard this before, copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear on this podcast. But most of the time, common sense is all you need. If you make extreme claims, or if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health and finance and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. Now, Ken, one of the things you told me when we were preparing for this second episode is that there are some blocking and tackling things, as you called them, metaphorically, about copy that just don't seem to get covered these days. I'd love to hear your thoughts on those and what they are.
Great. Well, you mentioned Claude Hopkins earlier, and one of the great, great lessons of Claude Hopkins, and this is not done by internet copywriters, and even a lot of some print copywriters didn't do it either. He was very big on spend a lot of time talking to real prospects for the product before you even dream of sitting down to write a sales letter. And I know Gary Halbert was big on that, you know, the value of talking to real people. There's some colleagues of mine in England who are, they're two of the top high-tech marketers in the universe. They know every tool and every trick in the book. They know how to track your eyes while you're reading their pages, and they know all this stuff. And their favorite method for when they take on a new client, they go to a flea market. They set up a card table, they put the product on it, and they talk to people all day about the product. And that's they think that's one of the best ways you can go. So that's lesson number one. Do not try to write copy in a vacuum. Do everything you can to get in front of people who are actual prospects for the product or users of the product too. That's another way to go.
Yeah. Ken, let me stop you and underline that. That's so important. It's something I've always done. I know on the letters I've written that for clients that have made over a million, even well over $1 million. I did that first. And when I'm talking to copywriters these days, it stuns me that they don't think of doing this automatically and that people are reluctant to do it and sometimes think they don't need to because they've got some abstract idea of their quote unquote, really hate this use of the word avatar, right?
Can we take that word, tie it to a cement block and throw it in the river? I despise that word. But
if you remember in San Francisco, right at the very southwestern end, there's a sewage treatment plant. The city's so liberal that they tried to get it named after George Bush. They tried to get it named the Bush sewage treatment. That never happened. But we can send it there. Yeah, I don't like it either.
Thank you for saying that. I don't think I've ever heard anybody else just come out and say it. I don't think it's real helpful. And you used a great word too, abstraction. There is nothing abstract about what we do.
That's true.
This is the least well, I'm not going to say it's the least abstract profession, but to me, we are on the same level, and I say it proudly. For both parties, we're on the same level as plumbers, as electricians, as craftsmen that go in and do the careful wiring and the careful soldering and make sure that everything's lined up the way it's supposed to be and there's no leaks and there's no frayed wires and that whole, and when you, so that when you turn the juice on, the house doesn't burn down. Those guys have a very serious job, and the plumbers have a very important job too. When you flush that toilet, if you want it to go. You know, you don't want it to come back up. And that's the level of reality that we're dealing with. There's no theory in anything we do, in my opinion. We're selling things, you know, which means there are people, and these people have attitudes and experiences and needs and interests and desires. And we better know those things inside and out.
Let's talk about that. Do you have advice on what kind of conversations to have with prospects or existing customers, or what kind of questions to ask them?
That's a good question. I would try to sell them it and see what happens. That's what these guys would do at the flea market. They would chat with people, you know, because it's a social environment. But then they would go into their mode of selling, and their goal was to get the person to buy the thing. So a great test is just, you know, answering questions is the beginning, because that's when you find out, okay, what's the confusion? Where are the doubts? I had a business way back previous to the real estate finance thing in the 80s. I was a young guy living in San Francisco, in New York City at the time. And in fact, I'm looking at my office. My home office is not huge. I got a lot of elbow room. It's not small, but my entire apartment in New York City was one third the size of my home office. So my whole life was lived in a space that was bigger than a closet, but not much. I was not eating regularly. I mean, it was a rough time. And I was doing direct mail then. And my direct mail worked this way. And this is going to all come to a point in a second. I would put up flyers. People would call me in the course of the conversation of me answering their questions and telling them about, you know, what I could do for them and when the next class was and so on and so forth. I'd get their mailing address. I'd add that to my little database. And then I would send them a letter. I didn't even know it was a sales letter at the time, but I tried to write that letter as persuasively as I possibly could so that they would come to my classes. I was teaching speed reading and study skills. That's what was my business. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what I did, so what I was doing was running an ad to get people to call. And then when they called, I would just talk with them. So I didn't have necessarily a set line of questions for them to learn. I was giving them an opportunity to ask me questions about the product that I was offering them, you know? And by the nature of their questions, I would understand, oh, they're confused about this, or they're suspicious of this, or there's something that they don't understand, or, oh, gee, I better put this in my next letter because everybody's asking the same question.
That's so really good.
Natural, I guess, so I would say lots and lots and lots and lots of natural conversations.
Yeah. Do you remember a specific of something about your speed reading course or study course that you thought was obvious? You know, curse of knowledge thing you thought was obvious in your flyer, and they said, "What is that? What does that mean?" And how you changed it? I know that's drilling down like 40 some years ago,
but it's getting a long time ago. But one of the things I learned, and what's weird is I discovered all this stuff independently by doing it, and then later read books about it and said, "Oh my God, this is a thing." People do this for a living. I didn't realize that. So I realized that a lot of people were fearful that they were going to take the course and it wasn't going to work for them. And I knew the course was going to work. And so I said, well, look, here's the deal. If you go through all five classes and at the end of the fifth class, it's just not working for you, I will refund your money in full. Now, this wasn't a strategy. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't a tactic. It was solving a problem, and it was also doing what I just felt was right. You know, I didn't want people to be fearful in the class because you can't learn when you're afraid. And I also felt like, well, I mean, I'm supposed to be a good teacher. If somebody comes to five classes and they're not making any improvement, then I screwed up. And they should get a refund. So. That was the biggest aha from conversations, was just the natural fear people have.
Okay, that's really interesting. So a lot of people come into copywriting now. They're smart. Maybe they've studied books. Maybe they've hand copied a lot of letters. They say, okay, I'm going to check all the boxes. Now I'm ready to go. Now I know what to do. But what you found out, I want to point this out to everyone listening. Obviously, you know it, but maybe people don't. You found out through the experience, through the physical interaction, through your own fear at the time of losing the sale, maybe through your empathic understanding of their fear of wasting their money.
Yes.
And so you learned it at a different level than a checklist and hand copying letters and reading all the books and going to seminars and getting a certification from somebody that you are a copywriter or whatever these clowns out there are doing today.
Absolutely. And remember, there were no classes in the 80s. There was no certification. There was Robert Bly's book. And I wanted to shout out to Robert Bly. I want to make sure I do that. Yeah. I first heard the word copywriter and realized there was a thing called being a copywriter thanks to Robert Bly's book. And he was one of the only guys writing for the public on the subject. It was an insider's thing. It was an industry thing. It wasn't for the public to know this stuff.
He's written about 80 books. So you mean the Copywriter's Handbook, right? Yeah. That was one of my first ones too.
Oh, you're too. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, you mean I could actually do this for a living? That's amazing. and guys who were listening, that was it. Bob was the only resource for the public. And if you were inside a shop or you're in an agency, then you would have heard about copywriting. You would have been exposed to certain things. But if you were a guy just out there on your own trying to figure this out, there were no guidelines. There was no help, which weirdly enough was a help, because sometimes when you have to figure it out yourself, you really figure it out.
That's another point. And boy, it's not fun a lot of times, at least for me. I mean, I'm impatient, and when I run into frustration after frustration, I want to throw something or start crying or harm a small animal. No animals were harmed in this podcast. And so Yeah, give us another. This is great stuff, and you're right. No one's talking about this anymore, and I feel remiss in not talking about it, but I'm glad you're talking about it, so please continue.
Well, let's talk about the issue of craft and the... I once heard this definition for genius, right? And genius is the willingness to take infinite pains. Yep. You know, so none of us are geniuses. I mean, I guarantee I was not, you know, I wasn't born this way, you know, but I pretty much guarantee, I can guarantee when I came out, I wasn't even speaking, and I didn't even know what language was. So anything that I'm doing was learned along the way, right? So I reject, I mean, there are people that work harder than other people. I just reject this notion of genius, that there's this free floating, just, I think it's bullshit. I think when you see somebody that's doing something well, you're seeing somebody who works his ass off on that topic. Yep. he may be a complete disaster in every other aspect of his life.
A lot of geniuses, so-called geniuses, are, yeah.
Yeah. And so this idea of taking infinite pains, which is the essence of craftsmanship. And what does it mean? It means if you're working on something, could be a sales letter, it could be renovating a house, it could be building a garden, whatever that thing is, that you don't look at the clock. You don't count the days. You don't think about how, I mean, sometimes you think about how hard it is, you know, your back hurts or whatever, but you're just doing what has to be done, and that's it. Like, nothing else on earth matters. That's craftsmanship, and that's why certain things are magnificent, because somebody just did not stop until everything was perfected as it could be, you know, in this world. And that's something I feel that you've got to have if you're going to be a copywriter. You have to have that for writing copy. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, we're all impatient. We all want to, but I'm sure, David, that when you're into it, you are going to get it right. You're going to keep at it. You're going to keep
polishing. Well, there's two pieces to it. The first is, I totally agree with you. The second thing is, you're not limiting yourself. You're not saying, well, I'm going to give this 2 hours because that's all it's worth. You're going to say, I'm going to do this until it's done. But as you really get into the flow, time disappears. Mm-hmm. I've had that happen with copy and with other things. Sometimes with mixing, producing music. I look up the clock because I don't even know what day it is. You know, really, you can go into this altered space. And the same thing with writing. When I'm really into writing, man, I don't know where I am. I don't know what day it is, what month it is, what time it is. Sometimes, I guess you could call it going into the flow or alpha state or trance or whatever you want to call it. But it's not, you know, going there like you're on some wild ride of abandon. It's like you are focused on getting it as good as it can be and going back again and again and again until it's, like you say, as perfect as possible. And a lot of people don't get that. A lot of people don't talk about it. Now, there are people who do it who don't really talk about it. You know, sometimes you might not want Joe Namath, reference for us old-timers, you know, to be the football coach. You want it to be the quarterback, right? Yeah. Yeah, great point. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, and I would say to anybody, whoever you are, whatever you're trying to accomplish, you know, you got to find that thing where it is work and it is hours, but that you have the ability to give yourself over to the work of whatever it is. And if you have that, you have a chance. You know, yeah. But if you're going into a field where you think you can just, you know, what do they call it in, you know, you can't call it in, especially, I mean, you can't call it in music for sure. And you definitely can't call it in copywriting. It's something where you have to give it your all. And so, you know, if you don't have that natural affinity towards that way of working in this space, it may not be the right field for you. But now on the positive side, if you're able to and willing to, you know, take infinite pains, then you've got something. I think people underestimate how hard a serious copywriter works. Mm-hmm. And I for some reason I'm referring to Gary Halbert a lot, but I mean, I know from what I've been told and heard that he really worked hard on those simple letters he wrote. He didn't dash them off. You know, when you see him on stage or when you see videos of him on stage, he just seems like he's sort of stream of consciousness and it all is flowing easily. I guarantee that all that stuff was very, very well prepared and very, 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 very well thought out. He had a great saying that I always love to share with everybody, that a sale is a fragile thing. And a good copywriter knows that you could easily take a wrong step at any point and blow your sales letter right up. And then this is a place where music and copywriting really come together. When you hear a piece of music, assuming it's tonal, you know, if it's atonal and, you know, shrieking saxophones, that's a whole nother world. But the music that most people want to listen to, people know when there's one wrong note.
Yep.
People know when, you know, one instrument is out of sync. I mean, they know instantly. Like, they don't need a degree in musicology to know there's a mistake. And there's that same level of fragility in copywriting. If you're not aware of that as a copywriter, you're missing a very important thing. Everything's got to have its place. Everything has to have a reason for being there. Everything has to have solid ground underneath it. You can't make a big-eyed, wild-eyed claim that you don't then support very thoroughly. Yeah. There's a lot of freedom and creativity in copywriting, but there are some fundamental rules. And one is you don't bore people. Right. Two, you don't tell them stuff that has no relevance. And three, if you make a big claim, you better make sure it's bulletproof backed up in your copy. And it's so easy to make a misstep, and a sale is a very fragile thing. You could be going along beautifully and start going into some line of bullshit, and you just lost them. And this is something, by the way, it would help copywriters to do some face-to-face selling. Get a job. It doesn't even have to be something elaborate or fantastical. It's, you know, just where your people are coming to you and you're talking to them normally. You know, I'm going to use Gary again. If you read Gary Halbert's copy, because he was a door-to-door salesman for years, you know, selling encyclopedias, there's no fluff. There's no wild-eyed, hand-wringing, waving going on. It is very pure, clean, straight language. Hey, you'd appreciate this, David. I found the follow-up letter to when I sat down to play the piano. They laughed. You know, the joke.
Oh, right? Yeah.
You know, the pros know that, yes, that's an ad worth studying, but the pros know that that's a lead generation ad. That's not the ad for the product. It's the ad.
Right.
You know, there was a letter that Caples wrote that came after you responded to the ad. And I've got that letter. And man, this thing is the simplest, clearest, cleanest, no hype English you've ever read.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it is clean. And a lot of people have this mistaken notion that we're trying to be clever. We're trying to be, literary. We're trying to use words with great skill. I mean, yes, we are trying to use words with great skill, but I think Gary Bensavenga said this, or if he didn't, he should have, but I think he did. It's an iron fist, but in a velvet glove. You know, we're very intent on what we're doing with this letter, but the glove is velvet.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I wanted to refer back to something you said a few minutes ago about taking infinite pains. What you're saying, well, it certainly reminds me of my own life and the best mentoring clients I have. And I say best mostly because they're the most successful people. And also, they don't whine when it comes time to, they complain like everyone else, but they willingly accept all the work that they need to do. I was wondering if you've read Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art, because what you're talking about, even though I think he's talking about other stuff than copywriting, it still applies.
I don't know that book, but I love the title.
Yeah, It's interesting. You might like it. I think the one thing I'm getting at, what you're saying is so fundamental, and yet we tend not to think about it because everything gets, well, you know, everything gets dried out with the internet. You know, human beings are wet. We're largely water. And, and you know, the internet is silicon and electrons and stuff. But yeah, you need to do all that wet stuff. And I don't take that too literally, or your mind could go in the gutter. But what I mean by wet stuff is talking to people, pressing the flesh, seeing their eyes get glassy or get squinty, you know, hearing them, you know, feeling their breath come out when they're mad. I mean, really getting in people's faces and having them get in your face to understand the experience of selling something, because that is what you are simulating on your side and on an imaginary other person's side when you're writing copy.
You know, a sales letter is just a sales call in print. It's a secondary thing to the dynamic of being in front of people and talking with them about your product. It's secondary. And so if you're trying to write copy without doing any of that preliminary work, it's going to be hard to come up with anything good.
But once you've done that work, once you know the person, not having gone through some kind of rote exercise where you imagine them getting up in the morning and you imagine them having orange juice, but you've actually met a person like this or a few of them, you've actually talked to them, you've actually offered this to them and found out what their objections are and what they're excited about. It doesn't make the writing easier, but it's a whole different experience. And usually the results are a whole different level higher.
Well, you know, so many writers in all fields, copywriting and novel writing and they always talk about writing to a specific individual in mind. I mean, think about it. Nobody sits there and talks. I mean, you might talk to yourself. That's fine. You might talk to somebody else, but nobody who talks in general to a non-visual descript audience. I mean, that you can't even do that. You have to have a target in mind for who you're talking to.
Well, I do have an answer to you. I'm not sure it's the one you were looking for. There's a homeless guy I know who does that a lot.
But yeah, right. I mean, but you know what? Even that person he's got some vision that he's talking to somebody.
Okay.
We don't know who it is, but so when a fledgling copywriter is writing a sales letter and is not clearly visualizing a target based on what you talk about, the wet world of human beings who have questions, doubts, curiosities, suspicions, it's going to be rough. It's going to be a rough haul. It's going to be hard to write it, and you're probably not going to get a good result.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's coming up in my mind now that's important to talk about in a practical way is imagination. And we've talked about it a lot. And I did a whole podcast on my belief about the misinterpretation of Einstein's statement, imagination is more important than knowledge, because it was taken way out of context in the way I see it. But here, we can put blinders on and, you know, put four corners around. It's very specific. And that is imagining the other person as though they're sitting in that chair on the table next to you. And what do you say to them and how do they respond? I mean, being able to do that so vividly, not that you're hallucinating, but that you can mock up in your mind how the conversation's going. When you can do that really well, that's when you start to improve your consistency rate of hitting winners, don't you think?
Absolutely. And you know, as you say this, I'm realizing that one of the things that I do is I project a skeptic. You know, I imagine a interested person. Obviously they're interested, but I assume they've been burned before. They're skeptical. They're tired of bullshit. They're intelligent, but not necessarily super informed, you know. And so I'm talking to a person with all those particular characteristics. So as I'm writing my copy, I'm making sure, is this clear? Is this straightforward? Is this simple? Am I backing this up? Am I linking this to reality that they can relate to? I'm not expecting a friendly, easy audience. I'm not expecting a hostile audience, but I'm expecting a normal human being who has seen a lot and hates salesmen, hates being sold. That's, by the way, something else we have to understand. Nobody wants to be sold. Everybody wants to discover something cool and acquire it and have it. Nobody wants to be sold or even persuaded.
So did you ever get to know Mac Ross, who worked with Jay Abraham?
Just by name and hearing some of his tapes.
Okay. So at one conference, so I got to know him. He was a mentor of mine for a while. An amazing guy. Unfortunately, passed away maybe 10 years ago. But he did this thing once at one Jay Abraham seminar, never said it again. And when I brought it up to him, he said, I don't know. he didn't remember. It just came to him. But I think in terms of what you're talking about, it's one of the most brilliant condensations I've ever heard. He called it the four W's. And he said that this is what's going on in your prospect's mind as they open your letter, start to look at your ad, look at your Facebook ad, look at your webpage. Four W's. Why are you bothering me? Who cares? Why should I believe you? Why should I do anything about it now? And of course, most that's, you know, it sounds funny maybe, but that's tough stuff to confront when you're in the space of actually writing. That someone is going to be that skeptical, even that hostile. But it's true, too, and I think it's very helpful. What do you think?
That's the most valuable thing you could tell a copywriter right there. I'm not saying that we should envision a hostile world. That's not what I'm talking about. But those four questions, that is what's in your prospect's mind. That's what's in your mind, guys. When you walk into a store to buy something, you're not all thrilled when the salesman, you know, runs across the room with his hand out extended. You're already backing off.
Right.
You know, that's part of this is too, just to think about your own mind very carefully and notice your own reactions to things. You like information, you like being helped. You like being treated respectfully. those are all positive things. You don't like being sold. You don't like being arm twisted. You don't like being lectured to. You don't like having to listen to somebody who thinks they're clever, right? You don't like any of those things. Your prospects don't like those things. So what's funny, and we're all guilty of this, we know that about ourselves, and then we err and act that way when we're in the selling process. I'll never forget this experience I had. I was having this wonderful back and forth, good conversation with a guy I liked and respected. And then halfway through the conversation, I guess he figured it was time to do business, and he went into a canned selling protocol on me, and all the connection between him and me just died. And I liked the guy, and I felt myself not liking him once he went into salesman mode. And this was something that, again, I don't know why I bring up Gary a lot, but this was something Gary was very, you could never tell when Gary was selling you. He was selling you all the freaking time, and you could never tell. You never saw the hook in the bait.
Yeah.
And that's something that we should all aspire to, being interesting, being helpful, informing, and leading, of course, because this is all supposed to lead to an action, but not being Joe Super Pro Salesman, NLP, expert of embedded. Forget all that crap, please.
I remember when I did my first and only sales training, and it was with a guy named Jim Camp, and he was teaching me the Sandler sales system, which I still like, although I think it's a little brutal. I think this is like a famous story among sales trainers. This guy goes into a prospect's office, and you know, the prospect says yes, and he pulls out his iPad or his flip chart or whatever he's got, and he starts to talk, and the prospect goes, "All right, I'll buy it." And the guy says, "Wait, You can't buy it. I haven't finished my presentation yet.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, listen, we're going to have to wrap up soon. Do you have one more quick tip? This has been so wonderful, but we got a time limit.
It's got to be quick.
Yeah, so please.
I'll pull out a quick one. Okay. Read your copy out loud.
Oh, yeah. A
couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
That's a quick one.
Oh, well, that was super quick. I really appreciate that. Well, Ken, thank you so much. Again, your website, which only recently came into being, is what?
Well, I had it up for years, but it was crap. But the last couple of years, the last couple of months, I improved it. KenMcCarthy.com. So it's my name, KenMcCarthy.com.
Okay. That's good. I've been there. It's an amazing site. Just the things you'll learn about him, about Ken. And Ken, this is incredibly valuable, unique stuff. This is our episode 110th, 111th, 112th, 113th episode. Things we've heard before and things we haven't heard before. And a real pleasure and honor to have you on. So thank you for doing this.
Well, thanks for asking me, and what a pleasure to be on the call, really.
Awesome. Great episode. Thank you, David. Thank you, Ken. Head on over to KenMcCarthy.com. And if you want to get more of your Copywriters Podcast fix, check out CopywritersPodcast.com. Until next time, we'll catch you later.
Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes so you never miss an episode.
This is the Copy and Funnels Podcast Network.